Ladies and gentlemen, I know that if you love this movie, then you appreciate one thing, and that's high standards. I won't accept a dog who's anything short of perfect, and I won't accept a cup of coffee that's anything short of the best there is, which is why I switched to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, from their Kickstart blend with a hint of toasted nuts for the Bloodhound aficionado, or
pine nut, walnut, macadamia nut,
or their decaffeinated unleaded blend for your high-strung Weimaraner. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this delicious coffee to your home or office within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug even offers autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. And right now, Sparkplug is offering a special discount when you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word, the number 100. And with that promo code, Sparkplug will give you 10% off any size coffee order. And you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. So what are you waiting for? There's never been a better time to start making your favorite cup of coffee in your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Go get busy, B! Get busy, B! There's someone who does not need more caffeine.
There is someone who needs a bit of decaf right there.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Happy 2018, film freaksters, and thanks for downloading our first episode of the year as we keep on gazing at movies that interest us. We were the AFI Top 100 people, but that venture has been done for more than 2 years, so on we go with just movies. Any kind of movie. We're spoiling fools, so know that now. I'm the underdog host with two left feet, Ryan Ellis, and here she is, the second kookiest for animals person I've ever met, my wife Bev.
That's me.
And who's number one?
Who is number one?
Jill.
Oh, yes.
Our friend Jill.
Yes.
The coming attractions trivia for this week's picture, Best in Show. Which dog should have won the contest?
The right dog won.
Look,
no. Look at Winky's face. He is so cute.
He's a good
choice.
I love
him so much. No. He's such a good boy. He deserved to win.
The Pomeranian should have won.
You know, you say that, but I find that that Pomeranian, who was probably a champion, most of the dogs in the movie are actually dog show champions. But our Pomeranian doesn't look anything like that Pomeranian.
He's far cuter, actually.
I find our Pomeranian way cuter. Like, he's a larger dog. He has a longer snout. He looks more like a regular dog, where the show dog Pomeranians tend to have the slightly more squished face and the higher forehead.
Yeah, right.
Although that Pomeranian was pretty cute, guys.
Maybe Rupert could have won. More for his owner, though, because Chris Guest is the cutest and most likable of all the dog owners.
You
at least
mean
the
Hubert?
Ones we follow. I said Rupert, didn't I?
Yeah.
Yeah, Hewitt. Right, of course. Sorry.
Rupert.
Wrote that down wrong. I actually wrote Rupert.
I think that the movie implies that Hubert will win someday, that he's just too young.
The judge even says that. Another
too
couple
fresh.
Of years.
Yeah.
He'll be a champion dog.
Yeah.
Another opinion question, and I think we've got some more of those coming. I got to find some good actual trivia questions, but I haven't had that many the last couple months. All right, well, the next 100 Project's 90th film, Best in Show, premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival in September of 2000. Then Warner Brothers, through Castle Rock, which is Rob Reiner's production company, released it about a month later in October of 2000. It didn't cost much, and despite not raking in a wheelbarrow full of bucks, it was a decent success that fall. Bev, explain for people what this movie's about with your Best in Show skinny.
It's the annual Mayflower Dog Show, where characters from all walks of life have gathered to display their pampered premium mutts for the judges and the film crew, who's there to capture all their foibles and neuroses.
Or, in a nutshell, Tramps Scamp Triumphs in Fatuous Tournament. Or,
Dogs!
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 A pure delight for Bev the whole way through, because it's just a movie about dogs.
It's true.
The Rotten Tomatoes critics say the movie is 95% good, 95% of them liked it, 104 fresh, 6% rotten, and 89% of audiences, so very nice scores there. It was 100th at the 2000 U.S. box office, The Grinch. We covered the animated version from 66, but the Ron Howard, Jim Carrey version was number one in 2000, Castaway was number two, and Mission Impossible 2 was number three.
But 99 movies made more money than Best in Show that year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, marketing, it's a mockumentary, no big stars. Even Chris Guest wasn't a big star. But it is one of the most likable satires ever made. I've seen the movie many times and still laugh out loud at much of it, if not almost all of it. It's a great comedy. What are your thoughts on Best in Show, a movie you've picked, your first one in the month of Bev?
I know, I picked it for the month of Bev, so you all know what I think of it, but you take a well-crafted, hilarious movie with an amazing cast, and then add a dog in nearly every frame of the film, and you have scientifically created the perfect film for me.
Do you laugh as much as I still do? I think you did. You laughed a lot.
I've seen it so many times that there's plenty of stuff that's worn off on me, but I still just find it so delightful.
Who's your favorite character of the humans?
Oh, Cookie. I love her. So, love Catherine O'Hara. I don't always love Catherine O'Hara, but in this movie, and I think it's more like Cookie and, what's her husband's name?
Jerry. Jerry Fleck.
Cookie and Jerry together as a couple.
Hmm. Okay.
God, yes. They're so sweet and lovable and wonderful together. I think they kind of like personify Christopher Guest characters because they are deeply flawed and easily mockable, but you still feel a deep empathy about them. They're just such lovable, wonderful characters that despite the fact that they're kind of losers in many ways, you can't laugh at them.
Well, they're the ultimate underdogs. They're set up right from the beginning. They can't even afford a room when they get to the hotel. But there is foreshadowing. Winky is the only dog we see win a contest in the beginning of the film. We hear about the other dogs that won contests, but we see Winky win one in Florida, and then he's the one that wins the big contest. Huge spoiler there.
I actually kind of want to change my answer. I mean, I still love Cookie and Jerry, but perhaps the best characters of the film, like the true scene stealers, are Buck and Trevor, the commentators.
Okay, yeah, they're great. Yeah.
Buck is hilarious. Who Fred Willard, being the movie total out of touch sportscaster,
rips the movie away from everybody else and says, "It's mine."
Has no idea what's going on, but Trevor, as his straight man, played by Jim Piddick.
Piddick, yeah.
Together, they make probably the funniest duo in the film.
Piddick learned all he could about dogs, and then Willard was told by Guest not to know anything because Willard is playing off of Joe Garagiola, a baseball commentator and former baseball player who would do things like this. I guess actual dog shows.
Yeah, he actually did dog shows. He did the Westminster Dog Show between 94 and 02.
And wasn't as funny as Willard, I'm sure, but was along the same lines of idiocy. Not so much asking how much he could bench press, probably, but asking inane questions. Things like, are they just judging the looks of the dog after it's almost over? Well, that's one of the best things that Piddick does in the whole film, the double take. We've been talking about this for 2 days. It's not just about their looks, you moron. Although it is a vanity contest, mostly because an ugly dog that can do everything else well would not get to the semis or win the whole thing. Let's face that fact.
You and I both love dogs very much. Me, obsessively and annoyingly so. Because I love dogs so much, I find the Westminster Dog Show, which the Mayflower is based on, to be almost cruel, like almost insane and absurd, and I have a hard time understanding how anybody who takes part in this kind of contest can really love dogs. It's an absurd way to judge a dog.
Well, even though they say it's not just about looks, it reminds me of a beauty pageant with, say, kids. How can you really love a kid if you're going to put them through that crap that you shouldn't be putting them through because they are children? It's bad enough that grown women or even older women, 16 or 17 years old, have to go through that, but kids or dogs who don't know what's going on. I like that point as well where Willard asks, the dogs sense what's going on? Oh, they have to. They know the tension. They don't care if they don't even know what that means that they've won a contest. At the very end, the last shot of the main story until we get the epilogue is Winky being held in the air by Jerry. The look on the dog's face is, I don't know, what are you doing? Why are you holding me in the air?
No idea what's going on. Right. They open it at the beginning where Bob Balaban's character is introducing the whole show and talking about how they set up the arena for everything. And there's going to be a lot of nervous dogs and there's going to be like a lot of disappointed dogs that go home at the end of this. No, they don't care. They are completely uninvested in how they do in this contest.
Makes you wonder about things like horse racing. Do the horses really care if they beat another horse?
I always wonder that. Do they know that they're racing?
Especially since they have those blinders on and can't even see the other horses.
Yeah.
They must be aware of them. They can see them if they're ever behind them. But if they're always in front or when they're side by side, yeah. Why are we running down the track so fast again with this guy on my back? I don't know. I guess we'll keep doing it.
And at least that's a skill they could improve upon and that they might be capable of understanding that this is the contest they're taking part in. But these dogs are walking around. They have no idea that it's really just their beauty that's on trial here.
Well, there's more than that.
What else, really?
I'm just
saying. Their
gait? Well, particularly things, talks about.
But things that they can't control.
Yeah, all right.
That really just make them, like, the ideal specimen. And I'll add even that breeders can act irresponsibly to get those perfect features. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes overbreed dogs because Dachshunds, they favor the shorter legs. And then that ends up causing back problems. And you have lots of Dachshunds that die young because they've been overbred to favor these really specific physical traits. And German Shepherds are another great example of this. There's lots of great examples of this. Dogs that suffer because their breed has been bred specifically for aesthetics. Rather than they should be bred for hardiness. They should be bred for personality.
And
for
long life, hopefully.
Yes, it's crazy to me that these are the standards they hold them to when that's the least important thing in a dog. And we should know our dogs are terrible specimens. We love them so much. We have one who's a purebred who would never win a beauty contest. Fox. He's very handsome in our eyes, but he is specifically...
Summer. Where is he?
He's behind us. Yeah. He's a Pomeranian. He has one eye significantly bigger than the other. He's probably about 3 pounds heavier than the heaviest you ever want a Pomeranian to be.
What are you saying?
And, like, it doesn't matter because he was neutered, so he would never be meaningful at all in a dog judging contest. And our other dog is just a total mutt who's also also blind.
Looks worse and worse as the years go on. We keep taking parts of him away.
But they're such good dogs. We love them so much.
That isn't necessarily true about the first people we see in the movie. And I asked you who your favorite character is. This wasn't true when I first saw the movie, or even the second time I saw the movie, but it is now. Parker Posey is a riot in this film with her intensity! And we see her, Michael Hitchcock, and their dog Beatrice first in the shrink's office. Later on, she has that incredibly awesome rant. Stupid hotel manager! Followed by the scene in the shop where she's trying to find a new toy for Beatrice. This is a parrot. It's one of those examples where if people didn't actually watch the movie and just listen to us, or if they'd once seen the movie and then listened to us but didn't remember the movie that well, they may not relate to what I'm talking about right now, but her intensity and the braces she's got on her.
I know. That they met in two... We met at Starbucks. Well, we met in two different Starbucks that were across the street from one another. So apparently, to prepare for the role, the two actors, her and...
Michael Hitchcock,
prepared specifically in Starbucks. They would do all their work in Starbucks. Initially, they were supposed to have a different kind of dog. I can't remember what it was, but then they changed it to Weimaraner, and they said when it was the first dog, I think it was a pointer. When that was the case, they were like, our characters only shop at Banana Republic. And then it got changed to Weimaraner, and they're like, no, L.L. Bean. We only shop at L.L. Bean. They had to match the Weimaraner, and her wardrobe is specifically meant to be all neutrals to match the dog.
The one dog that we follow in the movie, and people, of course, with the dogs, that doesn't make it to the finals. Every other dog that we follow in the documentary, this is a mockumentary, but it's supposed to be a documentary, they're the ones that make it to the finals. Nice coincidence.
I mean, lucky documentary filmmakers that, exactly. Like, all their subjects made it to the finals except for one.
2 points. One doesn't make it that far, so it's not completely a work. Okay, 3 points, because the second one is, it's a movie, so of course they're going to follow the people they care about. But the third point being, you could argue that they followed another 5 or 6 different couples, and they cut those out because they didn't make it to the
semis.
Maybe
they follow the Pomeranian. Maybe there's a movie somewhere about the Pomeranian.
There should have been. And the main story of the film is set in Philadelphia because that's where the Westminster Dog Show takes place. And that's the home of another famous underdog, Rocky. And Wiki's a great underdog, but more so his owners, Cookie and Jerry Fleck. Eugene Levy and Catherine Hare have been in a lot of movies together, often as love interests, including on a TV show that plays in Canada called Schitt's Creek. I'm not swearing. It is S-C-H-I-T-T-S. And there's a character named Larry Schitt, I believe. Chris Elliott plays him. I've only seen that a few times. Not a great
Schitt's
comedy.
Schitt's Creek is the name of the town. And you say it's not a great comedy, but it's very popular here.
It is, and they play a couple with their kids who've moved to Schitt's Creek. I don't even know the reason why. I've only seen it a few times. But they've been married couples, or at least love interests, in plenty of films, including A Mighty Wind, which is maybe a better version of the love interest between these two. The tragic, they were married, then they fell apart at the very end. Are they going to kiss at the end of the rainbow? Is that what that song is? I think so, yes. And then they do.
I remember.
At the end of, hey, spoiler alert, but A Mighty Wind, they do end up kissing, even though he is messed up. But in this movie, they're a weird match. It's a great notion that Cookie was an easy lay. That's the recurring theme over and over again.
And a great lay. Legendary great lay.
So many guys that have been with her before and recognize her and would love to do her again, if you will. But she loves Jerry now. Is she truly loyal? Well, she does say, you're my future.
She is loyal. She loves him so much. That's what's so lovable about them, is her past keeps coming up over and over again, but she actually seems to stay very true to him.
I agree, except for one little thing, that when some of the guys bring up this stuff, she sloughs it off. In other ones, she seems to be kind of, maybe.
She's enjoying the attention a little bit.
The Larry Miller thing, when they visit the family and he's the husband, at one point they're across the dinner table and he's saying something to her and I can't read his lips, but she's looking back at him, not quite as dismissively as she probably should be, if she's actually thinking, no, I don't want to be with you, I'm with this guy now.
And same when they're in the recording studio at the end and he says, I'm not wearing underwear. Oh, yeah, there is some interest or some enthusiasm or just maybe some fond memories of those bygone days or something.
But they do seem to be loyal to each other from all proof, at least. It's just suggestions.
And they seem to be like a very good couple. Like, they're very good for each other, and she supports him. And when he has to walk with Winky at the end, despite his two left feet, his literal two left feet.
Talk about intensity. Just like Parker Posey, the intensity as he's walking Winky around the track. But also Catherine O'Hara's great gammy leg.
Yes. Her performance of a, what is it, her injury? It's a dislocated knee or something?
That's something.
Oh, God, it's so funny.
I also like the one that happens to her. Everybody back there that's around, all the competitors, John Michael Higgins, Jane Lynch and whatnot, they're very supportive, as Marge Simpson would say, of Jerry. Now, maybe they realize, well, let this guy take this dog out of here, he'll embarrass himself and it won't win.
I don't read it that way.
No, I don't either. I think they're trying to be supportive of their friend, which is
a nice
touch.
I'll bring up a moment in a movie that you always bring up in Spellbound. What's the
Wordplay.
Movie? Wordplay, that's it. The one about
the crossword
puzzles. And there's a moment where one of the competitors thinks that their crossword has been misjudged. All the players, his competitors, get up together and fight for him on his behalf, knowing that he hasn't been scored properly and insisting that even though it'll cost them, that it's more important that the best man win.
Yeah, I love that moment in that film.
Even the most competitive person, who is Jane Lynch, she is showing them how to wear the armband, how to walk the dog. She's helping them out.
And speaking of Jane Lynch and John Michael Higgins, two of the dogs in the finals are owned by gay couples, including those two. And of course, the Jane Lynch and Jennifer Coolidge coupling doesn't really become evident until later on. But it's a very progressive film in that way, because we've got, what is it, five couples that we care about? Well, it's probably at least six dogs. I can't remember whether there's six or seven dogs, whatever it is, in the finals. And two of them are owned by couples who are out. Although, then again, the owner is not Jane Lynch. It's that old dude. Stifler's mom and him both sharing a love of soup.
Soup.
One of her best soup. Line reads ever is the love of soup.
We love talking and not talking. We could go forever and never run out of things to not talk about. Oh my God, she's so funny.
And the year before that, she was Stifler's mom, the polar opposite character, which she plays here. Although a little spacey. Well, she wasn't really spacey actually in that movie, was she? But she usually plays the spacey character that she is in this film.
So she based the character on a trophy wife that she babysat for when she first came to Hollywood. And she said that this woman was very feminine, but also very phony. And she considered this part a little bit of revenge for her old boss.
As for Jane Lynch, it took me a while to warm to her as an actress. I wasn't a huge fan of her in this film. Not that she's bad, but she is off-putting because she's supposed to be. That's the way it's written. She definitely took hold of me in 40-year-old version, where she was very funny. They all were funny in that film. And then she's really made her name on Glee, but she's become, I mean, she was then, I just wasn't really seeing it, a great actress and a very funny actress too.
She was a nobody when she got cast in this film. And now, if you look at the cast, she might be the most bankable star in the film. If they were to, like, remake it, she would probably get the highest salary. Maybe there might be a fight with Eugene Levy and Catherine O'Hara.
But she'd be up there with them.
But she would be up there. Lynch not only credits Guest with propelling her into the spotlight, she also said working with Christopher Guest gave her the way of working that suits her perfectly. And that made her a better actress. And that part of the reason that this film propelled her into stardom was because she found a way to work that works best with her. Get the most out of a part.
You said the name Bob Balaban a little while ago, and he and Ed Begley Jr., who are also regulars in Chris Guest movies, great old pros. They both have small roles in this film. I guess Begley actually is on screen more than Balaban is. Begley does mention the rock band that had been in the hotel, which was clearly supposed to be Spinal Tap, a reference from the Chris Guest movie that he made with Rob Reiner and Michael McKean and Harry Shearer. Did you notice the clocks in the hotel? They're all the same time zone. New York, Philadelphia, and Boston or something like that.
What a great touch.
It's also nice to see Begley talking about the hotel so much. It's a kind of waste of time that he'd be talking about the hotel so much in a dog documentary. But it's just an excuse to get Ed Begley on screen a little bit more. And maybe to show the anal retentiveness that they all have. The people about their dogs, but this guy about his hotel. Does it really matter to the audience? No, but it matters to him.
Well, I would say that Christopher Guest movies all share this one thing in common. He is singularly obsessed with fringe groups of passionate people who treat their obscure and sometimes absurd passion with total seriousness. Whether it be dogs or the hotel that they run or mascots or
folk singers
or the play, the terrible play
for her consideration
that they're in. Yeah. That's Waiting for Guffman. That's what I'm thinking of. Yeah. Regardless, he just loves those kind of nobodies who are passionate about their own little world. And Ed Begley Jr. is just another example of somebody who's passionate about his own little world. This is his hotel. He's very proud of it. And he's a very good person. He bends over backwards to accommodate Cookie and Jerry,
yeah,
whose credit card won't go through. And he doesn't embarrass them. He doesn't roll his eyes at them. He finds them a place to sleep for the night. He accommodates them as best he can.
He's very likable.
Part of what makes Christopher Guest movies work so well is he has a real love for these characters, even though he's making fun of them. His own character kind of gets at the worst with the nut naming and the ventriloquism.
I think he's the sweetest character in the whole film.
I think he's the one character who treats his dog the way his dog should be treated. He loves Hubert so much, gets on the ground with him, takes him for walks. Mm-hmm. That's the only dog we ever see going for a walk.
Well, we see Rhapsody and White running.
That's true. In the kennel, we see Rhapsody and White running. Other than those two scenes, can you think of a scene where any of those dogs
forget going on a walk?
How about having their paws on the ground? They're either in a kennel, Beatrice is always in her crate, or they're being held, the Shih Tzu, always being held by those two guys. And Winky, always in her arms, always in Cookie's arms. Never do Winky's feet touch the ground unless they're competing. But Hubert is the exception, and he is a really sweet guy. They're all sweet, though. That's my point.
I do like that his characters are ventriloquist, and he gets into that more when the film's over and we see the epilogue.
And he gets into it more with his HBO series, Family Tree?
Yeah, but I mean just in this movie alone, though, at the end of the film, he's got more into that. He still has Rupert and he loves him, but he's not obsessed about winning this contest. Maybe he'll go back and try to win it. Jim Pittock says this can be a champion dog in a few years. And then Chris Guest, who's been great in some of his own films, he's the best thing in Waiting for Guffman, I think, as Corky St. Clair. Although my favorite moment in Waiting for Guffman is when he comes back to the play and you see Bob Balaban in the background with this wide open mouth because he's taken over for the play for a little while. It's the best thing Bob Balaban's maybe ever done in a comedy way. I remember laughing my head off at seeing that in the background. Just the shock and awe. What? He's back? But he's the best thing in that film, I think, Chris Guest is.
Yeah.
Not so much this. He's the nicest thing in this film. He's not the funniest thing in this film. He's actually the straight man of all the main dog owners. He's not really all that funny in the scenes we see with him.
And he
naming nuts isn't even really all that funny. It's his best character trait.
He's the one person that doesn't have a scene partner as well.
Yeah, he's a solo dog owner in this room.
Yeah, the rest of them have couples and they have somebody they can play against, but he's just on his own monologuing about nuts.
As for these dogs, they were very well behaved throughout all the filming, and I was reading that only one time was there a bark that wasn't scripted, because, of course, Beatrice is supposed to act up and get kicked out of the contest. But if you look, and they say this online, if you look closely, the judge is holding her hand in such a way that she's got treats. That's why the dog is going after her, because it's been trained to do that for the treats. They had to get that for the scene, but otherwise the dogs were legitimately well behaved.
And they were all actual champion show dogs. Some of them were champions in Canada, not necessarily international show dogs. Most of them actually were Canadian champions. There's a reason they're so pretty. It's because they were legit show dogs.
It's a little bit thrilling at the end to find out who's going to win when they wait and see, what's it going to be? And cut to all the people's faces of all the main characters that have made the finals.
And because Christopher Guest makes the movies that he does, and because you just love all the characters as much as you do, you really are never rooting for anybody. Except maybe with the exception of Rhapsody in White, because
rooting against the overdog.
The overdog, yeah, because
with
like
Jane Lynch being a
first of all, Rhapsody in White, yeah, she's a dick and the dog has won too many times before, so you know that's not going to be the winner and you don't want him to be the winner. But whether it's Winky or the Shih Tzu or Hubert, how can you actually pick a favorite? Any of those winners would be a success and a happy ending.
There's a distinct lack of black people in this cast, or any non-white people for that matter. Is that a common thing for guests since then with A Mighty Wind and For Your Consideration and Mascots? I think it probably is.
Yeah, I'm trying to think and I can't think of any non-white people being in any of his movies.
It may not be an intentional choice if he doesn't work with a lot of black actors or Indian actors, as in from India or Asian, whatever. Then he's not going to think to cast them. Doesn't make it okay, but I can understand why you wouldn't. And he's going to work with people he knows and trusts. And it happens to be white actors he's worked with so much of the time before.
I think the day is coming when that's just not going to be an acceptable excuse anymore, and nor should it be. I think you could safely argue that if you go to the Westminster Dog Show, it is my bet. I have never watched it, but I bet it's mostly white people. This seems like such a white people thing to do, to judge your dogs. Who's the prettiest dog? That just seems like a real white culture thing.
Yeah. Talk about unnecessary.
Yeah.
So Michael McKean and John Michael Higgins are the gay couple. McKean is basically a legend at this point, I would say, especially in the comedy realm of movies and TV. He was in Spinal Tap with Guest and Harry Shearer. He's been in the other Guest films, or at least a few of them for sure. He was in A Mighty Wind, and he was in, I think, For Your Consideration. And now he's on Better Call Saul and stealing the show, even though he's up against some great actors in that, but it's stealing the show as Chuck McGill. John Michael Higgins is a character actor. He's mostly done TV. And even though he's playing a stereotype in this film, what you might call flouncy gay actor, he is funny, including when they check in the hotel. What are you implying, my good man? So it's a little bit stereotypical, but it is humorous.
In the year 2000, that portrayal of a happy, monogamous gay couple was probably refreshing. They were kind of goofs. They were a little over the top, but they really were happy couple.
Neither they nor Lynch and Coolidge are mocked for their sexuality either.
No.
And Lynch and Coolidge only comes out at the very end of the film. Fred Willoughby did talk about him. He doesn't appear until 45 minutes in, and I've noticed that with so many movies we've covered where a horror movie doesn't have anything horrific happen until maybe 30 minutes in, or an important character doesn't come into a movie of any type until 35, 40, 45 minutes in, and that certainly applies here. He was talked about, at least I remember hearing about this, maybe for Best Supporting Actor at the Oscars in 2000, but did not get nominated. The only nomination this movie had of any kind that was really all that relevant, it got some nominations on various guilds and things, but the Golden Globe nomination for Best Comedy, it didn't win in 2000, but it was at least nominated for that. Nothing at the Oscars, nothing else for the Globes and the actors. How do you nominate one actor, though?
Totally. Because apparently Pittock had a pretty limited amount of time that he could shoot. They had to shoot all of their scenes in 2 days. So they spent the first day just reviewing all the footage that they had already shot of the dogs in the contest. And then the following day, they just had like one long day in front of the cameras, the two of them doing commentary on everything that they had seen the day before.
And there's plenty of scenes with Willard or Pittock on camera by themselves, which is fine. Every once in a while, you're going to have a scene with a character on screen by him or herself. But that's probably also where they did shots, where the other guy wasn't there, I'm guessing.
Oh, yeah, that's totally possible. And apparently, people said that no one's ever seen Christopher Guest laugh harder than he did when he was trying to keep it together during Willard's shoot and his jokes.
But let's not forget that Guest movies are mostly improvised. He and Eugene Levy co-write them. They've written Waiting for Guffman together, A Mighty Wind, obviously this, and For Your Consideration. But they don't write them in the sense of an actual screenplay. They just give an outline to the actors, and then they all together work on these scenes. This movie came in with 60 hours of footage, and Robert Layton cut that down to 90 minutes. Where's his Oscar nomination to make that mass of footage work?
Excellent point.
And he was Reiner's editor before and after this movie. He's become guests since this film. Great job. I think you would agree, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We recently watched Mascots on Netflix, and we both agreed that it was Christopher Guest's biggest failure. I hate to say it.
I don't remember anything about it.
It was really unfunny. They probably just didn't shoot enough to get those great moments, to be able to whittle down all the great moments into 90 minutes of it. Although, even as I say that, there's a lot of scenes in Best in Show that are not funny. They really just move the plot along, or they just give you a moment of character.
Well, not every moment of comedy is going to be funny.
They have a lot of resting moments where you're just being charmed by what's happening, but there's not really laugh out loud moments in every single scene in the film. But it felt like Mascots, there just weren't any laugh out loud moments.
Family Tree, the TV series that he did, wasn't all that funny either. He put up on that for what, two or three episodes?
Yeah, it's true. Although I found it maybe a little more sustainable than Mascots was. And more interesting is the documentary about the actress who's in that show, who's a ventriloquist. An excellent documentary called Her Master's Voice.
So Guest has done The Big Picture back in 89 with Kevin Bacon, Almost Heroes, which I don't think I've seen. I don't remember seeing that one. And then his mockumentaries. That's what his filmography is as a director. I think this is definitely his best work of all those, although A Mighty Wind is pretty damn good, too.
Of course, Rob Reiner directed it, but he was highly involved in Spinal Tap.
Yeah, Shearer, McKean, Guest, and Reiner have always said that was their movie that they shared, but Reiner got directing credit. And he probably really did direct it, but it was more a matter of, well, one guy has to take directing credit, so it'll be him. And I guess he really was the director, but anyway. And then they all wrote it together, effectively, just like this movie could have been written by, I don't know how many actors are in this thing, but 12, 14 people, but it is credited to Guest and Levy. But it's not like they've ever said, it's our movie that we wrote and these guys didn't. No, they've always said, the cast wrote this, but somebody has to get actual Writers Guild credit, so it'll be us, because they wrote the outline. Their producer was Karen Murphy, who worked on Drugstore Cowboy, Spinal Tap before that, and then future guest films. So mostly she's worked in the comedy genre, but that Drugstore Cowboy thing really stands out to me because that's a damn good movie, but it's not, well, actually, it's not that dour for a drug movie. There are some humorous moments, but she's mostly worked with Guest, and of course that's going to be the comedy realm. He is one of the more funny modern people we've ever had, but so dry, so great at being dry. The movie's 185:1. We watched the DVD, which was fine. It was solid. It wasn't exactly the greatest print in the world. It was. Did I read on your notes it was 16mm?
Yeah, they shot it in 16. All handheld cameras. The way you would shoot a documentary. When you have to shoot that much footage in 2000, obviously you wouldn't shoot it like that now. But in 2000, when film was still your only reasonable option, you shot in 16, and that's what they did.
The cinematographer was Roberto Schaefer, who worked on other guest projects, and also Stranger Than Fiction, a movie we liked a lot from 2006. The music score was by C.J. Venston, a regular with Guest, whose best work has to be on A Mighty Wind, because that movie is all about music. The influence, I don't think there's that much from this film, but it obviously took its mockumentary cues from what Reiner and the other guys did with Spinal Tap. It's certainly in that same vein. Guest must have liked what they did way back when. It took him a while, though, to get back into mockumentary filmmaking, because Waiting for Guffman was 96 and Spinal Tap was 84, so 12 years later until he directed his own mockumentary.
But there's a story there.
Our Guest and his regulars, the best comic group of the modern era, especially with mockumentaries, so there's an influence. Are they influencing other mockumentaries?
For mockumentaries, I think, yeah, it's like a no-brainer, although that's some pretty stiff competition. How do you even begin to judge who's the best comedy troupe of our generation or modern era?
When it comes to this genre, though, of mockumentaries,
they've
got to be.
There's not really that much competition for the mockumentary
it's a hard thing
genre
to do.
In particular.
But that started, I think, it certainly was before Spinal Tap, with Real Life, which we just watched a few days ago. And that was Albert Brooks, 1979, 5 years before Spinal Tap, and then way before any of the Guest movies came out.
And, you know, I always say, when it comes to comedy acting, comedy is commitment. If you want to be funny, you have to play like your character is 100% convinced that their feelings are real and legit. There's no genre that is more true than mockumentary. The more convincing you are in the absurd notion that you believe in, you can just look dead in the camera and assure everybody that there's nothing you care about more than a judge determining that your bloodhound is the best dog in the world, then the funnier it's going to be. There's just no genre where it's more important than mockumentary.
And it wasn't the funniest moment of the film, but I think my favorite reaction, or maybe favorite moment the Guest has as an actor in the whole picture, is when he doesn't win and they cut to the various faces. Jane Lynch has that, oh, come on, look on her face. But Guest as Hall and Papel, he just says that kind of like, eh. It's more this initial disappointment with, oh, well, the other guy won. It's not the, what the hell? No, Jane Lynch has that same sort of feeling. It's a sweet moment where he's not that broken up about it. Okay, this was an enjoyable way to start 2018, one of your first of three choices in the month of Bev, your birthday month, where you will turn 40.
That's right, baby.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
She'll be in her fourth decade. Your last thoughts on your first pick, Best in Show.
I give Best in Show a blue ribbon for being a very good boy.
Who's a good boy? Who's a good boy? Right behind my ear. I'm a good boy. There's huge laughs and a feeling of goodwill all the way through. Beauty contests are stupid. For humans or for dogs, but everyone involved knows that and pokes fun at it in this movie. It's very well done. It is Guest's best film, I would say, maybe even by a lot, although A Mighty Wind is pretty close. I don't think we own anything else he's directed. Of course, we have Spinal Tap, and that's better than this. That's the best mockumentary that he or anyone's been involved with, I'd say, ever. But of the ones he's directed, I would say that this is the best one.
Yeah, I agree.
When we amble in your direction in 7 days, folks, we'll head over to war-torn Spain. What a big left turn. For Guillermo del Toro, I can never say that guy's name, his movie Pan's Labyrinth. So the coming attractions trivia for next week's picture, again, it's an opinion thing. I gotta have some questions again one of these days, an actual thing I gotta look up. But is GDT better when he directs foreign language films or English films? The answer may surprise you. It's not as obvious as you think now that he's come out with a movie that's getting a lot of acclaim, The Shape of Water.
So for the answer to that question, please check out next week's podcast about Pan's Labyrinth. And if you just can't wait that long to hear from Ryan and me, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. We've covered well over 200 movies now, including all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American movies ever made. And every episode is available for free. All we ask is that while you're there, if you could rate us and review us, we would appreciate that. It means a lot to us. It helps people find us. And if you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I'm at BevEllisEllis and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it's not case sensitive.
I'm going to go out and get a toy for our dog, Mr. Stupid Hotel Manager!
And cut!
Macadamia nut, pine nut, walnut, cherry nut,
red pistachio nut, green pistachio nut, all natural white pistachio nut.
What are you doing there naming nuts? So he is funny.